The second case for oral argument this morning is the Elvine Family Limited Partnership with the appellant versus James Hageman, Hageman Red Angus, and Floyd Demery, appellees. For the appellant this morning, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, who is an attorney from Sioux Falls, and we have for the appellees Mr. Mark Meyer Henry and Mr. Williams Blewett, also attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Meyer Henry, I understand you'll be presenting this morning. All right, very well. The court should also note that Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself, and therefore we have appointed the Honorable Jack Von Wald, who is the presiding circuit judge from the Fifth Circuit, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's place. Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court and counsel. There's a truism in American law that one person's rights extend right up to the point just before they begin to infringe upon the free exercise of another person's rights. And at that point, rights transfigure into responsibilities and legal duties. In some cases, when you're talking about negligence or other types of legal invasions, the line is hard to draw. But in property rights cases, that line has already been drawn. You can find it on a map, and Mr. Alvine could walk it in his hunting boots. It's a property line. And this case is about one neighbor committing a trespass on another neighbor's private land. Frank Alvine is the head of Alvine Family Partnership, and he's a physician who lives in Sioux Falls. But he always had family in Lake County, and he grew up working on relatives' farms. And in 1973, he began purchasing some land of his own in Lake County, and he ended up acquiring about 800 acres. He grows beans and corn on about 200 acres, and some of it's CPR land, there's grassland, there's wetlands, and there are two main lakes. And his family has had a cabin there and used the land there for hunting, fishing, recreation, swimming. You know, they pull 5-pound walleyes out of the lakes. They're about 25 feet deep, and they total about 15 acres. The lakes are also actually tributaries, and they're supported by dams that flow into the Vermilion River and then into Lake Vermilion. The land of the north was owned for, you know, generations by the Demery family, and George Demery lived there, farmed it, had some cattle for many years, and these neighbors peacefully coexisted for decades. In the 1980s, George Demery became unable to farm, and the property was eventually inherited by his son Floyd. And the land had already been leased to Jim Hageman and Hageman Red Angus, and he had a cattle operation there. And it started out pretty small, but by the 2000s, they were up to 260 head of cattle there, 130 cow-calf pairs, you know, it would vary. And they were kept for the most part in a feedlot that was situated right on the border of these two properties, right across a gravel road, right next to the inlets that flowed into these tributaries and then into Mr. Alvine's lakes. And the flow in the spring in particular was heavy. Mr. Hageman began a practice where he would collect the manure produced by these, you know, 250 plus animals in massive piles right on the border in these feedlot pens, right across from the gravel road, giant 15-foot-tall piles that he would store it there because he wanted to use it as fertilizer. And the USDA NRCS estimated that his cattle produced 2.6 million pounds of manure annually. Much of it would be just collected and stored for months and months, and spring would come, and this manure would wash into these inlets right across the road and end up in these lakes. About in 2000, when the cattle operation started burgeoning, the Alvines started to notice that their lakes were becoming infected. And they had a tremendous weed growth, algae bloom. And the kids, you know, within a year after that, then in 2001, 2002, it became so bad that the lake was so overgrown that it was hard to launch a boat in places. And, you know, his kids grew up fishing there. His grandchildren were now there, and the lakes essentially became unusable. They smelled. All the fish died. And they were overrun with algae and weeds. And so they had a problem. They went and did some testing, and the phosphorus levels in these lakes were off the charts. There was ammonia in the lakes. There was fecal coliform and E. coli in these lakes. And they suspected, quite logically, that it was these massive piles of manure that were just left on the precipice of their property. So they went in 2002, approximately, to Mr. Hageman, who leased the land, and Mr. Demaray, who owned the land, and began to tell them about, you know, this is a problem. Mr. Hageman's own nutrient management plan, if the court reads anything, I would encourage tab 6. It specifically talks about and informs Mr. Hageman about these problems, and it describes how the phosphorus is a pollutant, and it's toxic to groundwater and surface water in these types of levels. And if you have manure, and it's all listed in his plan, if you have manure and you leave it there without it being contained, if it runs into groundwater, it will cause these massive phosphorus concentrations. And this E. coli, this is a deadly bacteria. So essentially the grandkids couldn't be in the lake couldn't be fished, it couldn't be used. And we had a period of about 5 years where this would repeat. The excuses that were made were, and I understand the quandary, Mr. Demaray would say, hey, I only rent the land. I can't put in the containment pond that would fix this, according to the USDA. I just rent the land. It's not my property. Mr. Demaray would say, I'm not going to put these in here because I don't raise cattle. I'm just renting the land to somebody who does, and I don't want those on my land. And so we had this play over for 5 years. These piles would remain there. Every spring they would wash into these lakes, and the lakes were ruined. Luckily, there is remediation you can do for phosphorus. And so the Alvines began this program of putting alum treatment into the lakes, and that helps, that brings the phosphorus into the sediment, and that solved a lot of the problem. But we still had E. coli, and you have to, it's not a permanent fix, you have to keep doing that. So after about 5 years, an action was finally brought in late 2007, because nothing was being done. I mean, they did put in some grass strips to try to ameliorate the problem, but these giant walls of manure were still bordering their property. And so an action was brought. We had a summary judgment motion on the trespass claim brought by the plaintiffs. That was denied without explaining what the disputed facts were. We had a trial, and a jury held for the defendants. Do you find for the plaintiffs, yes or no? It said no on the verdict form. We had a motion for a directed verdict before that on the trespass claim, saying this is a trespass as a matter of law. The court denied it without elaboration, without explaining, without referencing law or facts. And then after the judgment, we had a motion for a judgment as a matter of law on the trespass claim because we believed it had been demonstrated beyond dispute, and that again was denied without comment. So we really haven't had a judicial explanation of how this is not a trespass. We respectfully suggest that it is clear error and abuse of discretion to have not granted a directed verdict on the fact that a trespass occurred and to have denied the motion for judgment as a matter of law.
So you're saying, because we very rarely, as you know, overturn jury verdicts here.
Yes.
That there simply isn't a factual basis to support the jury's decision.
That's right. This is an exceptional case, and this court's precedent allows for this type of exceptional case where you can't dispute that we have under the law material flowing onto another private property. And now the law that has been applied, and this court has, there's not been a definitive adoption of Restatement 158, but every time the court talks about trespass, it references Restatement 158. And that says that one is subject to liability to another for trespass, irrespective of whether he causes harm to any legally protected interest of the other, if he either enters land in the possession of another or causes a thing or a third person to do so.
But as I understand it, the jury wasn't instructed about that definition of trespass. The jury was instructed on the definition that required a showing of substantial damage to the property.
Well, the jury wasn't, I believe, instructed on the essence of Restatement 158. It was jury instruction 12, and there is a reference to damages at the bottom of that. But in the statement of law, it I believe, tracks the Restatement 158 fairly closely. It is jury instruction 12. And it says, civil trespass occurs where an individual or individuals intentionally and without consent causes a thing to enter land in possession of another or fails to remove a thing from another's property that he has a duty to remove.
We only resort to treatises like the Restatement if the legislature has not spoken. Has the legislature spoken here?
Not to my knowledge, and not to any statute that's been cited as relevant to the trespass claim.
Because there are some references in the code to trespass, but you're saying they don't go this way.
I don't think so. And they may be criminal references to criminal trespass. Here, the cases this court has used, is it's referenced the restatements. It's a common law claim.
Mr. Parsons, back to the jury instruction, though, you only read half of it. The second element, the first element required that the intentionally caused a thing to enter the land, and then it says, and, subpart 2, that the trespass was a substantial factor in causing Alvine Limited Partnership harm. So it seems to me that the, for whatever reason, the jury was instructed that the elements of trespass, you had to prove both.
Well, I would suggest that that's establishing a claim. The definition of trespass is just above that, and that tracks the restatement. So, you know, there's a reference to damages, and to recover damages, certainly it would have to prove damages and show it was a substantial factor. But I would suggest that the restatement was the proper law, and that's reflected, and it's not a perfect jury instruction, but that's reflected there.
Well, what does subpart 2 mean?
Well, I think subpart 2 means that when you're finding that there are damages, you're awarding damages on this claim, that it has to have been a substantial factor in causing those damages, or the harm, as it says. And it's not a perfect instruction, I concede that.
Well, it says to prove trespass, you have to prove two things.
To establish the claim, and then it's, up above it says trespass occurs, and then it gives the legal test. And then I guess it'd be to establish a claim. I mean, I understand what you're saying. There's some ambiguity in the jury instruction.
Well, why would we be reversing it, though, if that's what you're asking us to do? Because the jury could have, even the jury may have agreed with you that there was a trespass, but still found there was no substantial damage, and therefore you can't recover. We don't know which the jury did. But what would be the point of us reversing now and saying, yes, there's trespass, but we're going to uphold the verdict because the jury says there's no substantial damage?
Because the damages are a separate element, and it's important to protect a legal interest if a legal interest is violated.
But hasn't the jury already ruled on that, on the damages? It's a general verdict, so we don't know whether the jury said, yes, there was a trespass, but no, there's no substantial damage. Well, that been decided?
I don't think it has been decided because, and under the law, and we've had some concessions on appeal, that the elements of the restatement and the examples in the restatement constitute trespasses. If you order a directed verdict, as we asked for, and we believe was an error not to grant a directed verdict, on the fact that a trespass occurred, and I don't think there's any dispute a trespass occurred, then that's what we believe the court should have done. The court should have entered a directed verdict, and the jury then could make a determination on damages. And that's what we've appealed from, is the denial of a directed verdict. We have facts that establish under the law a trespass. I mean, the extent to which, and we suggest the damages aren't debatable as well. I mean, we've suggested that the damages were demonstrated as a matter of law. I mean, you have deadly bacteria, fecal coliform, and phosphorus that it's undisputed is in this water. And no reasonable jury could conclude that is not a harm to this land. I mean, that's the second part of our argument.
Wasn't there also evidence, though, that I realize the evidence of the millions of tons or millions of pounds of manure is strong evidence, but there was also evidence of some deer herds being encouraged to graze and feed on the land.
Yeah, you know, the deer, where the evidence shows the deer were to the west of the lakes, downstream, but yeah, there are deer on the property, there are migrating geese, but no reasonable jury, I would suggest, could contend or could conclude that when you have literally millions of pounds of manure right in these inlets, I mean, visuals of it, and testing right at the inlet, I mean, testing done right at the source, no reasonable jury could conclude that that was due to migrating geese.
But it's beyond just a reasonable jury. You presented this argument to the circuit judge, by my count, at least three or maybe four times, and all four times, and at the end of the trial, he'd heard everything, and he still didn't agree with you.
All four times, and never explained why it was not a trespass as a matter of law. Never. Not even a sentence. Not even a case. And I think it's because you can't conclude that this was not a trespass. I mean, private property law is strict. I mean, we place a lot of importance on private property. You can't just flush these toxic substances onto someone else's property. And under the elements of that this court's talked about under the restatement and that are generally applicable, this was a trespass as a matter of law.
Well, you know, Mr. Parsons, I know you didn't try this case, but the trial counsel, in arguing the motion for directed verdict, and everything that we have to do flows from that, suggested in his argument that causally related harm was an element of trespass. I note that the way he argued the case, he first argued the intentional intrusion, and then argued causally related harm, and then concluded, we've established the elements of trespass. So it seems to me that for some reason, trial counsel presented this case to the trial judge under this same theory that causally related harm is an element of trespass.
Well, in order to prove damages, I mean, it certainly is.
Well, he didn't say, he wasn't talking about damages. He said the elements of trespass.
And that may have been a statement he made at one of the hearings. He also argued, I believe, that we have established trespass as a matter of law by showing that the manure has come over onto the property. And I believe that argument was made as well at the motion for directed verdict and in the summary judgment motions and made on the motion for judgment as a matter of law. I mean, I understand that this could be sent back to a jury for a determination of whether damages occurred and to what extent they occurred. And we're asking the court to hold that these damages were established as a matter of law, but I understand that could happen.
So what's your relief? Are you asking for another trial, or are you asking for an outright ruling from this court that Elvines win, or where do we go from here if you're right?
We're asking that judgment be granted as a matter of law on the trespass claim, and that at a minimum it be remanded then for a trial on damages. At least money, nominal damages. I mean, that was the Bartles case that this court had. And there the trial court found, yeah, there's garbage coming from one property onto another. And the trial court said, but I don't see any harm, or whatever it said. I mean, the ruling's not really elaborated, but the trial court denied relief. And this court reversed and said at least they're entitled to nominal damages because of the presence of this foreign matter that's been deposited on their property. And that's the exact relief we're asking for. This case is not about money. I mean, this damages claim could have been built up, and if this was about money, I mean, we wouldn't be here. This is about protecting their property rights. This is about protecting their land. And so that's why we believe it's so important that the trespass law doesn't become scrambled.
Why should the case be remanded for another trial on a different theory of trespass, under a pure theory of trespass that didn't include the causally related harm?
I don't concede that was the only theory that the case was tried on. I mean, I see that there's an ambiguity in the jury instruction, but The restatement 158 is in the jury instruction, and counsel argued that we had established a trespass as a matter of law, I think irrespective of establishing harm. I mean, these things are tied together because they did have a damages claim. The primary defense here has been that, you know, there should be some kind of agricultural exception to the law of trespass. And we should not scramble the law simply because the pollutants in this case, the toxic chemicals, came from a feedlot rather than a factory. I see my time is up. I'll address...
you have about 30 seconds.
I'll stop there and I'll wait for my rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Meyer-Henry, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel, and justices, all the parties are here as well today, so that's kind of nice to see. We're all here to listen to this case. First of all, I want to talk about procedure for a moment before I get into rebut the arguments of my colleague. This is a narrow case, and I urge the court to keep it where it should be in our estimation. They chose to appeal only the denial of the motion for directed verdict and the later motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict. I think usually we wouldn't talk about that, but my colleague is a very fine appellate lawyer, and what he's trying to do is try a different case than was tried. And here's why. He's arguing that at the motion for directed verdict before the jury was instructed on the issue of trespass, that this court should adopt the pure old trespass definition. Yet, when he made the motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, the element of damage was added to the restatement, as Justice Zinner was asking about, and that's the law of the case. What he wants this court to do is to ignore the law of the case, which he did not appeal. He did not appeal the element of damage, which the jury was instructed. That's not before you. Instead, he wants you to forget, basically, about the motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, take a definition of the law that he's argued in his brief, which is the definition flowing from examples that go back to 1827 on theories of trespass that is the restatement. No quarrel, the restatement says what it is. So let's get it clear, at least from our perspective, that the narrow case to be decided here, as presented by the appellant, is did the jury have enough disputed facts to make the decision they did? And was the trial judge able, both at the motion for directed verdict, before the jury verdict, and after the jury verdict, to say that there were disputed facts such that a reasonable jury or reasonable judge could differ? Because they're alleging that Judge Tucker abused his discretion, there was that no judicial mind, in the view of the law, and the facts of the case, or the circumstance of the case, could have reached the same conclusion. So you have to find that Judge Tucker, having heard the case, could said this jury had no facts to find that, by the way, these are not lakes, we're still disputing facts, these are not lakes, these are stock dams. And there's a difference. However, the evidence of the case shows that Lake Madison water quality is not as good as, or no better, than the stock dams on the Alvin property. That disputed fact alone is such that if you read the restatement, the jury has to find that if one is to be subject to liability, he has to intentionally, we differ and we think the facts differ there, but he has to cause a thing to go on somebody's property that interferes with that person's possession. My colleague here is excellent at the use of adverbs and adjectives about toxic waste. Yet the evidence of the case, as disputed from the defendant's side is there was nothing toxic about it. I refer the court to page 482 when I asked the question of Mr. Meyer, who was a witness, former employee of DENR here in Pierre, but now in private practice in Sioux Falls, is there fecal coliform in mud? And he answered, yes, it's everywhere in mud, actually. Is it in nature without cows? Yes, it's everywhere. Contested throughout this case was whether or not there was an exaggeration of harm claimed by the Elvine Family Partnership when its water quality equaled or exceeded those people living around Lake Madison. It was also disputed of what caused the algae bloom. Was it, as was testified, and I think the facts are indisputable, that there's a herd of 200 deer and that those deer are sought by the Elvine Family Partnership? I think not. Again, to show the disputed facts, there was some testimony about buffer strips. And by the way, the buffer strips were put in at Mr. Demaray's expense to the tune of about $30,000, takes up 12 acres of land because of the disputative nature of the Elvine Family Partnership. They tried to get along. The jury could have well found that any trespass did not occur by any actions, any intentional actions of these defendants. Just the opposite. Nothing had changed over 100 years of farming. This land is zoned agriculture.
Well, Mr. Meyer-Henry, it seems to be a dispute brought up by Mr. Parsons that under the restatement 158 definition that harm is not an element and is dealt with in the first part of jury instruction 12, under South Dakota case law, regardless of the jury instructions, but at the point of directed verdict, court was not dealing with jury instructions, under South Dakota case law, is harm an element of trespass?
There is no South Dakota case law. The only place that this honorable court has discussed this is in footnotes and in dicta and references. You have not had a case where the decision held, we have adopted Restatement 158, Your Honor. Or at least I submit we didn't find it.
So we didn't. The court also has never found that harm is an element of the trespass.
Nor that it is not.
So this is a case of first impression?
Probably. But that's not the case you're trying about whether you've adopted 158 or not. The case you're trying is whether Judge Tucker was right in determining whether there was enough evidence for the jury to find that there was no trespass. For example, the restatement uses the word thing. What's a thing? Something, everything, not a thing. The evidence disputed was his adjectives are toxic. Well, nobody testified it was toxic waste, but that it was toxic. Our evidence was everything in the runoff from this one ag property to the other was natural. Whether human beings had never, ever appeared on these properties, wild animals had. The same elements come from wild animal waste as from cattle. The jury could have well found that there was no thing in the idea of a trespass that went from one farmer's property to another if it's a natural occurring thing.
But, you know, it's pretty tough to say, though, it's naturally occurring when you see this stuff running over the road.
Well, if you read the record, there's a big exaggeration here. First of all, this isn't a feedlot. This is a disputed word throughout the case. This is a wintering corral. This is where they put the animals over the winter. They're there. You see it everywhere across ag land in South Dakota. This is where they wintered the cattle. They kept the cattle there. All the testimony in the case is the husbandry in this case was above average and so forth. This is not a feedlot. This is not anything like that. There's a reason why the plaintiff never wanted to mention environmental protection. In fact, you'll read the record, I couldn't mention it because no environmental laws were ever discussed. Well, the reason's obvious. It didn't violate any laws. And so this is a case where the jury could well find that there was no trespass because everything occurred naturally and nothing that the defendants did was intentionally or caused anything to flow onto the neighbor's property. I think that's a disputed fact. It's their case, not the defendants. They didn't ask for a definition of the thing. I don't think a justice or a judge can guess what the jury thought about what a thing is, but our side of the case said we did nothing to harm the Alvine property. Nothing has changed in 75 years. These are stock dams. They're cleaner than the lakes that people build hundreds of thousands of dollars of property around to live on. And they're saying that these stock dams, one of which is illegal, should be better water quality and that we've harmed it. Well, they have to fall back. They didn't appeal the negligence because there wasn't. They didn't appeal the nuisance because there is none. They appealed, and they're trying to, in my humble opinion, use one little snapshot of the motion at the end of the case before the instructions of law of the case are settled and urge this court to, in effect, not follow the standard that Judge Tucker is bound by and other circuit judges are bound by, but was there enough evidence? Or was it clear that the restatement, which is not the law of the case, that the restatement was violated? I submit to you our brief, plus just this argument today, shows there's disputed facts. I mean, a jury could clearly find a neighbor who uses good husbandry, who we all know if water comes within nature, within against manure in nature, whether it's a coon or a cow or a deer or whatever, or as I walked in to argue this case, the goose droppings on the sidewalk here on the Capitol grounds. Their argument is when the water hits those goose droppings on this property and flows onto the neighbor's property, the neighbor has a trespass action against the state. I'm sure the state's immune, but private property owners are not. So the jury could have well found the thing is not anything we care about.
Now, was there a special verdict proposed by either side?
You know, I was looking at that. I don't remember how that came about, but at least the defense did not. I just don't remember how we got to the verdict form, but it's kind of a unique verdict form. It asks, I think it was Judge Tucker's, very frankly, and maybe Ron can, Mr. Parsons can correct me, but the answer is I don't remember, but there was none denied. There was none that I recall submitted by the plaintiff and denied.
So both sides were okay with going ahead with a general verdict?
Yes, that's my recollection, unless the record would prove me
wrong. One other question. Now, Mr. Parsons has faulted the decision of the trial judge because he did not enunciate why he made his decision. Does that hurt your case?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've been up here on summary judgments, and as I recall, trial judges don't have to explain summary judgments and write findings of fact, conclusions of law there either. No, this is a jury trial. The other way, perhaps, is apparent. I mean, the judge observed it, and the judge said, no, I don't think the judge has to do that. I don't know why the judge would want to. I mean, here, the hurdle that the plaintiffs and the appellants have is you must find your colleague looked at these facts and was wrong. Then let's look at the facts. This was a disputed case. My clients dispute, looking at the restatement, whether any reasonable person could find that these defendants intentionally caused the thing to enter the property. I mean, we can argue this case forever. What did they do? They did nothing that had not been done for 75 years, that is not normal, in ag zoned area that is not done as we stand here by landowners everywhere. The exaggeration from our standpoint is the Alvine argument is if someone has an oak tree and they planted that oak tree and a leaf falls and then the wind blows it across the lawn, that there is a case for trespass for that oak leaf, whether it caused damage or not.
Isn't there a substantial difference between an oak leaf and one and a half million pounds of manure piled up 15 feet high?
It depends. If you listen to all the facts, there is nothing in the record to show what quantity, if any, of the substance of that one fact went onto the neighbor's property. Justice Severson, that's the problem with their case. The problem with their case is they didn't prove it. They didn't prove any damage. They had a couple little test tubes, parts per million, that they argued to reasonable jurors. And these reasonable jurors listened to their expert laminologist. He never explained how can, if all of these terrible things are occurring from one neighbor to the next, how can these stock dams, and I think it's in the common knowledge of any judge in South Dakota what a stock dam is as opposed to Lake Madison, how can these stock dams be equal to or better than Lake Madison? So when you read, irrespective of whether he caused any harm, leave that aside. You simply ask the question as we prove things. Did they intentionally cause a thing to enter the land and remain there? Maybe they could have simply said, the jury could have simply said, they must not have. Otherwise, there would have been some effect, some cause beyond the condition of these stock dams. So in this case, by not appealing the law of the case, I think he's bound by the law of the case. I think that's a problem. Because otherwise, you have to put the spotlight between the end of the case, because that's the only place he can urge you under your prior precedent not to just retry this case, rewrite the instructions, do the whole works. So immediately, the plaintiff should lose on the law of the case, the motion for directed verdict, because that's not the law. It's clear that they didn't prove any, well, that the jury could find that they didn't prove any damage. And that's not discussed. So we go back to the middle, and then were there facts? We pointed them out. There's such things as, well, there were buffer strips. Well, their expert, and talk about believability, their expert said, well, the buffer strips take care of all the wildlife that was attracted and was on the property of the plaintiff. Here's some good testimony from defendant Hageman. He kind of sums it up, as farmers tend to do. They get to the heart of the matter at page 222 of the transcript. I asked, do you recall what Mr. Osgood, their expert, Mr. Osgood said about the drainage through the buffer strips? Answer, yes, that it works to catch deer manure, but it doesn't work to catch cow manure. The idea being there was a question of fact of what caused the damage, if any, to these stock dams on the Alvine property. So if you look at the record, and we've cited in our brief instances where there were differences of opinion about the facts. I mean, really, what you have to say here is the jury was outrageous. It was a runaway jury. I submit to you, Dr. Alvine, the Alvine Family Partnership, was represented by excellent lawyers at trial. Read that record. Mr. Cockrell is a damn good lawyer, and he presented the best case they could. And there was a reason they didn't appeal negligence, because they didn't prove any negligence. And there's a reason they didn't prove nuisance, because he's got great water quality in his stock dams. And they didn't appeal that. So they go back, and they don't really appeal the motion for directed verdict, because that's a different motion And they would urge you to find different elements. So on the record, this is a narrow case. And I would urge the court not to venture into what is the law of trespass in South Dakota. Let's go back to what it is here, whether there's sufficient facts the jury could find that there was no trespass, whether it's 158, the restatement, or the law of the case that adds the element you got to find damage as well. It doesn't make any difference because the narrow part of this case is simply that Judge Tucker abused his discretion because this jury ignored and didn't have any facts to rule for my side of the case. I've been accused by some, even a member of this court at times, to be somewhat arrogant. But I'm certainly not arrogant enough to think that I'm able to win a lawsuit in front of a fair-minded jury with no facts. With no facts in dispute. I think not. I think that's what the trial judge heard the case, heard it all, heard the motions, read the exhibits, saw the exhibits, and it was his decision, granted without comment. I don't know any civil rule requires it without comment, that said there was enough facts and he let it go to the jury.
Thank you. Your time is expired.
We would urge affirmance.
Okay. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was eager to get back to my seat because I was eager to dive into this transcript so I could address Justice Zinter's point. On page 467 of the trial transcript, Mr. Cockrell tells the court, I can tell you that when Mr. Meyer rests, I was planning on making a motion for a directed verdict on both the damages portion and the liability portion, Your Honor. And so then we have the motion for directed verdict on page 555 and 556 of the trial transcript. And Mr. Cockrell makes his argument on the liability portion of the trespass claim. He says, if you recall, I specifically asked Mr. Demaray and Mr. Hageman, did you intentionally place that cattle operation there? I'm not going to quote exactly, but then he goes on to say, did you know that fecal material was going to run onto the Alvine's lakes? And they admitted that they knew that. And they said, yes, I knew it would happen. They told us it would happen. We could see it happen. There are photographs of it happening. And that, in fact, that's why Mr. Hageman testifies in the record. That's why we put it there, because it was the best place for drainage. And after Mr. Cockrell then goes through the directed verdict motion on liability, he goes through all the liability elements, and he says, we have established the elements of trespass. So that was his motion for directed verdict on liability, on establishing a trespass. Then, further on page 56, he goes on to talk about his motion for directed verdict on damages. He says, as far as the harm, the damages to them, they have no testimony that the harm did not occur. They have no testimony that the alum treatment was unnecessary or effective, and so on. So there is a bifurcated motion for directed verdict, one on liability and one on damages. Even if the court doesn't accept that and construes it as one large motion, there is, as a matter of law, there was harm under this jury instruction. There was harm. There was an invasion of the Alvine's land, and that is harm. There is manure on their land. There are these chemicals. I mean, there are photographs of it. They admitted, and that's the key point. The testimony of the trial is that they knew this was happening. And in 2002, they knew it was happening. In 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, manure was going into this property. They knew it. They intentionally put the manure there so it would. And they left it there. And that establishes trespass as a matter of law. We were entitled to a directed verdict, I would suggest, on whether a trespass occurred. And we moved for that. And we made a motion for judgment as a matter of law on whether a trespass occurred. We also suggested that the damages were demonstrated as a matter of law. And I understand that there can be dispute about damages. But at a minimum, under this court's case in Bartles and other cases that we've cited from all these other jurisdictions, we're entitled at least to nominal damages because property rights are that important. And a directed verdict on that basis and a judgment as a matter of law on that basis, I would suggest, is very important. It's certainly important to the Alvines. It's important for the development of law in this case, and I think it's warranted under the law of the case and the law of South Dakota. I'd never heard the argument that manure is not a thing. That's the first I suggest that's being raised on appeal. I guess you can do that as an appellee. But clearly, and under these cases we've cited, now we've got cases from the Alabama Supreme Court, Nebraska Supreme Court, Montana Supreme Court, Illinois Supreme Court, all of these cases, and they talk about, and the examples in the restatement that are in jury instruction number 12, restatement 158, as a summary of the law, show that if you cause a thing, if you build up the example in the restatement is if you build up sand on an embankment and you know that that is probably going to flow into your neighbor's property, that's a trespass. Under South Dakota law, in this court's case in Wumpsa, if you're on public land and you shoot a shotgun and the pellet goes over private land through the air and lands on public land, that moment of the shotgun shell going through private property, the air above it, that has been described by this court as a trespass under South Dakota law. Now, if that is a trespass, how is not having a wall of manure polluting an entire neighbor's property, how is that not a trespass?
So, Mr. Parsons, can the defendants have any cattle on their land then?
Of course, Your Honor.
I mean, what if one cow urinates and it runs downhill and it goes across the road?
Of course, Your Honor. It's apples and oranges. And we have this example of we're going to have lawsuits about blowing leaves. I mean, that's what they're resorting to in this case. This is a massive amount of manure, and it ruined private property. And the example from Mr. Hageman was, Mr. Hageman has other feedlots. This is a feedlot. And Mr. Hageman has other ones. He has another one, at least. And he has a containment pond there because he built it because he owns that land. He didn't build it here because he doesn't own this land. And he's only renting. And Mr. Demaray, who owns the land, didn't want it because he doesn't raise cattle.
Do you have an evidentiary problem because the other side says that basically the pollution is caused by 200 deer rather than these cows?
Well, I think that goes to the extent of damages. There's no question that there is an invasion of land and a harm. I mean, having manure on your property and E. coli and that types of thing, they're in the inlets. Right next to the road is where it was tested. And we have photographs of the manure coming onto the property. That's a harm. And I would suggest no reasonable jury could conclude that that's not a harm. And the standard is, you know, it's an exceptional case, but judgment of a matter of law should be granted when the evidence on the behalf of the moving party is clear and full, credible and not contradicted, and so thin and complete that reasonable minds could come to no other conclusion. And reasonable minds could come to no other conclusion that this manure entered the Alvine land and it was a harm. Now, the extent of the harm, I concede, could be debatable, and that may be something a jury should talk about. But the jury was not entitled to find this was not a trespass, and at least nominal damages should be awarded.
Mr. Meyer Henry argued about the word intentional, that this was not an intentional
invasion
under the wording of the statement.
Yes, and I think
that makes this not appropriate for directed verdict.
I think it's in the jury instruction and it's in the restatement of intentional. The element of intent has been defined by these courts as being substantially certain that the thing you've placed there is going to enter the other's land. And that's under the restatement of torts, comment I, and it's in all these cases we've cited, the Nebraska Supreme Court, the Lambert case. And they admitted at trial they knew that this manure was going to enter and was entering and continue to enter the Alvine property. And so that establishes the intent element under South Dakota law. And under the jury instruction, under the law of the case, I would suggest. So this, you know, this is a narrow case because it affects two people. But its property rights are extremely important in South Dakota and given great accord by this court in its decisions. And, you know, a man's home is his castle. His land is the one thing he can say, or a man or a woman, this is what I own. I can protect this. And when those lines are crossed, there has to be at least someone to say, this, under the law, this is not permissible. This is a trespass, even if it's just a shotgun shell. And so a directed verdict, because of the law and the law of the case, because it was established, no jury could conclude that the invasion of manure onto the Alvine's land did not cause some harm, that it was not a trespass, that it was done intentionally under the definition of the law in the jury instruction and in the restatement. No reasonable jury could conclude that. I mean, this is not a case where the jury was free to disregard the law. And that's why we have the Supreme Court, and the jury's role is done in terms of whether there was a legal violation. Now it's this court's duty, and I would ask this court to consider strongly reversing and granting judgment as a matter of law on whether a trespass occurred.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. The court will be in recess.